Welcome everyone to another episode of the Jetstream Off-Season. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with a former New Zealand international who joined the Jets in their inaugural season in 2005-2006. Over a season and a half, he made 31 appearances, scoring 9 goals during the time as a part of a potent Jets strike force. Welcome to the podcast, Vaughan Coveney.
Hello guys, how are you?
Great. Doing really well. Thanks for coming on and spending some time with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right, we'll get straight into it. You're a household name back in the days of the NSL, essentially where you were scoring goals for fun, but you weren't signed by any team initially as part of the A-League's inaugural season. Was that a decision on your behalf, or did you have outstanding commitments with South Melbourne, who you were playing with at the time?
Yeah, no, it was... At the time, yeah, I was with South Melbourne at the time, and the NSL came to a finish, and then what happened was I was also in talks with Melbourne Victory at the time with Ernie Merrick, but we couldn't come to terms. So I decided at that present time I was working and playing, so. I just stayed. I stayed with South Melbourne at that particular time until the opportunity. Then, when the Jets phoned and it sort of that started the ball rolling from there.
So you initially moved to the Jets as a loan from South Melbourne. What were the circumstances of the move, and how did that approach actually happen?
Yeah, so the approach came from John Paul, JP at the time. Who I think was the assistant coach to Richard Money. And then what happened was I think Craig Deans at the time got an injury, and I was on loan as an injury replacement, so I could go there for 3 months. He was ruled out, and so and that was for me, that suited me. At the time I had a young family. And so my family stayed in Melbourne, and then I was just up there for the 3 months. So that was just it was a really good fit at the time, it just flowed on from there.
Do you remember your first appearance for the Jets?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, if it was, I can remember, it was a Perth away.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, Perth away. Scored with a header from a cross from. Oh, golly. Now, maybe Jade North or someone, I can't remember exactly, but I remember. Yeah. It was really good because, I'd just come into the team and I hadn't been training very long. And I wasn't even sure if I was supposed to go on that trip away to Perth. But at the time, the boss basically said, yeah, you come in. And, that was it. Yeah, it was a good memory, actually. Yeah, good day.
A little bit more about that match. It was against Perth, as you said, and it was across from Jade North, and you managed to actually lose Steve McMahon Jr., who I think is a pretty controversial player back in the day because he was the boss's son.
Yeah.
But during that match, you said you did score. You became the first Jets player to score on debut, and you're only actually one of six Jets players to have achieved that feat for the club.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, you joined the likes, well, the likes of James Holland, Milton Rodriguez,
yep.
Milos Trifunovic, Joey Gibbs, and, oh, geez, the last one escapes me.
Okay.
That's all right, but they're all in that club with you. And funnily enough, that win, that 1-0 win, is the last and only time that the Jets have won in Perth.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So bit of interesting facts about that match. So yeah. You hold a special place in just for that match alone.
Yeah, no, it's not an easy place to go. As you can understand, the travelling and the time difference, it's, you're waking up early in the morning. Over there as well, like you wide awake at like 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning or something ridiculous like that. We're walking around the hallways, but I like going to Perth, and they had some good fans at the time as well. And I, you know, we weren't, you know, at the time, I don't think, you know, we were predicted to do anything over there as well. So it was a bit of an upset, I think, on the actual day. So it was nice to come back with 3 points.
How have you ever been involved in a team? I mean, it's probably something that's quite underestimated by fans, just how difficult it is to travel to Perth with the time zone differences. Have you ever found a successful way, or what has worked best for the team that you've played for traveling to Perth?
Yeah, well, in the past, we just got on the plane and left. But now, obviously, I'm in a coaching role now with Melbourne Victory, but we do it a little bit different now. We sort of stick to the time zone. So in the eastern states. So if we just have a run sheet that basically we just stick to it. And once we get to Perth, we're still on, as you would say, Melbourne time. So we eat at the same time, we sleep at the same time, we get up at it'll be really, really early in the morning over there. But we just seem to think that it. And when we've gone there as a youth team. I think it's helped us. So I don't know what other teams do, but in the early days we just went there and flew there and did everything. But now we change it. Obviously, trying to stick to our pattern because we don't get there early enough to sort of as you would say, climatize or to get used to that time zone, because it's 2 or 3 hours is a big difference. So, it's helped us. So I think we'll continue probably to do it.
Yeah, okay. You scored 4 goals in only 10 appearances that season, because you came halfway through the season, as you said, and to score 4 goals was certainly a very good strike rate. And 2 of them were actually match winners before the team, I guess, were knocked out of the semi-finals because they were struggling. The team were struggling for form late on in the season. Was there a sense of missed opportunity in the camp that season?
Yeah, I think there was. I mean, we definitely had the caliber of players, at that time as well. We had some very good players, Nicky Carl. I can remember Stewie Mushalik, Ned Zelich, Paul Ocon, Jura as well. So we had, and Joel was there as well. So, we had a good team. We just couldn't quite put it together. But then I think the latter part of it, we started to hit some form. And then we got knocked out in Adelaide.
That was the second season.
Oh, was that the second one? Was
it? That was the second season. The first season was the home and away leg against the Mariners.
The Mariners, yeah, that's right. Yeah. But look, in saying that, I remember that those legs as well. We were unlucky, but that put us in good stead for the following season, where we had a very competitive team. There was some good household names there.
Yeah, well, I guess talking about that, you did leave the club and then returned the following season, having signed a contract with the Jets. But the team was vastly different. I mean, gone were the likes of Ante Milicic, Ned Zelich, Mateo Corbo and Richard Johnson, but in came players like Paul Ocon and Joel Griffiths, who you touched on just before. Did you take on a greater leadership role within the team with a relatively young squad at that time?
Yeah, I did actually, because I remember even when I first went to Newcastle, I was quietly surprised because at that time, I was in my early 30s, and as people these days, if you're over 30, everyone says you're past your time, but I would have been. Well, in the first season, I would have been in my 33, 34, I reckon, around that age. Mm. So then, to get another season, I was delighted. And so then that's when once that happened, then I brought my whole family up and, we settled in really well. So, but, to answer your question, yeah, I did have to take on a more of a leadership role. And, we had some good young players as well.
I mean, The Jets started off quite slow in that second season, which resulted in the coach, Nick Theodorakopoulos, being replaced. But it was during that time that many people recall a match in Sydney that saw the introduction of Colombian Milton Rodriguez, who scored a double on debut. Yes. I guess, unfortunately, in that match, you were the player that made way for Milton to come on.
Yep.
But you played with many great strikers at the club during that time, from Milicic to Griffiths, Rodriguez, and as well as up-and-coming youngsters like Mark Bridge and Labby Haliti. Who was your favourite partner to play with during your time at the Jets?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually.
You probably know who to say to make all the Newcastle fans happy.
Yeah, I like Joel. Yeah, no, I like playing with Joel. Like he was just a, you know, he was a good, you know, good person. I got on well with Joel. You know, we worked well together. He's a similar type of players in a way as well, you know. But then also, I remember playing with Nick Carl as well, because he was different to me. Like he was a ball player, creative type player who created a lot, probably created a lot of the opportunities and, you know, assists, you know, for myself and other strikers as well. So we're, you know, as a striker, you're always, you know, looking for those type of players. So he was another one as well. But yeah, look, those names, you know, when I think back, well, yeah, there was a bit of quality there, and you know, all of them, even Milton as well. You know, he was another player that made a big impact when he came to Newcastle as well. Didn't speak much English at the time, but mate, he had some left foot. It was one of the, you know, best left foots I've probably ever seen. Dead ball stuff as well.
I think it's probably safe to say that you make up, and I touched on it earlier, you probably make up part of the most potent Jets strike forces that we've had in the club's history. And it's I guess, sad to say that we've had that over season one and season two. But the depth of strikers and the quality of strikers that we had, both coming through in terms of young players and first team starting options, just hasn't been replicated by any of the Jets teams.
Yeah,
any of the Jets teams since we probably got close with Taggart and Heskey.
Yeah,
but there just wasn't the depth behind them. So you know, these were prosperous times for the club, and you make up part of it.
Yeah, no, it was, and I think you know, the good part of that as well, like there's competition as well, and competition for places that, you know, that brings the best out of you as well, because you're always, you know, looking over your shoulder and, you know, wondering, you know, am I going to start this week, or am I going to, you know, blah, blah, you know. So those things are always running through your mind. And so at a training session, you can never, you know, can never rest up. And that's why I think with any A-League club or any team, you know, if you've got good depth and you've got good competition for places, that just strives everyone to be their best or, you know, to be at their best. So when it comes for selection time, that you're putting your hand up, and that's what I, you know, at that time when I was there, those strikers that you're naming, and even the young ones, you know, and Bridgie and all that were coming through at the time, well, you know, they were good young players, and you know, put a lot of pressure on the more experienced ones. So you know, I think that's where, you know, we were, like you say, we had potent strikers, and you know, we scored a number of goals in those couple of years.
The club made a slow start, as I touched on earlier, to season two, and there had been a change in the off season that you probably would have recognised, with Richard Money being replaced, as I mentioned. Despite playing in the opening four rounds, you were absent from the side for the following three matches. Funnily enough, these are the only three matches that you'd missed during your time at the Jets. You featured in every other match that you were available for. Well, was available to be played in that league. What was the feeling like in the camp at the time with Nick and the struggles that the team were having, which ultimately, I guess, led to him being replaced as manager?
Yeah, look, it's always a difficult time, you know, when a manager's in there, and you know, you're not getting results, and you know, it's a tough time, not just for the coach, but you know, for the players as well, because you're down on confidence. You know, you're always looking for answers, and you probably, you know, now it's different for me now because I'm a coach now, and I always reflect that, you know, when I was a player, you know, as a player, you're sort of worried about yourself and worried about what you're doing and how you're performing, and you know, it's a very difficult situation. And then, you know, results aren't going your way. Then the fans start, you know, not turning up and getting on your back, and you know, and then ultimately the coach is the one that pays a price, and you know, and Nick did, and you know, that happens, and you know, it was unfortunate, but you know, and then we get replaced with another coach, and then, you know, it's funny how things change.
Yeah, it really is, because I mean, I guess that Gary Van Egmond stepped into the team as the interim manager after Nick's departure, and you returned straight to the team, and over the next few matches, you'd score 2 goals in consecutive games for the team. What was the difference in approach between, say, Gary and Nick that made the team, I guess, suddenly click and start to perform?
Look, I think when Gary came in, he sort of, you know, he gave the players a little bit more freedom, yeah, just in and around the dressing room, and I think he got his more experienced players and as captains and as leaders on side early, and you know, that you know, and to be honest, you know, he had a lot of good players in there, and you know, they not that he didn't coach, but he sort of, you know, we had a structure in place, but it was pretty simple. We understood it, and yeah, he let us sort of express ourselves a little bit more than probably Nick at the time, and I think that showed on the field as well, because you know, we went on a good run, you know, and that was it, really, you know.
Yeah, that's great. A memorable moment from that season was a length of the field goal by Nick Carl in a 2-1 win over Adelaide. I think it was Carl Viet put a very late penalty directly over the bar as well that would have sealed the match for Adelaide. You had been substituted and you were on the bench at the time. Do you recall the goal and I guess watching Nick go?
Yeah.
And how were the celebrations on the sideline in the dressing room afterwards?
Yeah, no, it was, you know, I remember that. Yeah, it was awesome, you know. Yeah, look, he's a match winner at any time, you know, and to do that as well, going probably the, you know, the whole length of the field as well. Yeah, I remember, you know, jumping off the bench, and it was crazy, you know, and plus, you know, at the time as well, I think, you know, the fans as well, because, you know, I know with Newcastle, you know, at the time, when the team's doing well, like this, they're fantastic, and they get behind the team, and we're getting pulling some, you know, good crowds as well. So the atmosphere was awesome, and again, you know, the result was, you know, fantastic.
I'm surprised. You should remember the match as well, because you did score in it.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, you did. Oh. And that match, look, for me personally, that match is something that is a very special memory for me as well, because Harry Kewell, oh, I'm a Liverpool fan.
Yeah.
And Harry Kewell was injured at the time, and he came, and I don't know how it happened, but he did a walk around the field prior to the match. And okay. I managed to actually get a Liverpool jersey signed by him, which I still remember where I was, and still watching Nick Carl, because I was up the end that Nick Carl scored that goal as well. It was in the 90th minute, and yeah, just that is one of my clearest memories I have. Where I was standing, everything I was—it's one of the matches I have the clearest memory of. That moment in particular, anyway.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, look, that there's a bit of perspective from a fan's side of things.
Nah, fantastic.
The Jets continued to march on, and you scored the crucial goal at home against Sydney in the semi-final in the 71st minute. Do you remember the match, and can you talk us through the feeling? That's a question from a fan, submitted from someone on Twitter. So
yeah, no, that that game in particular, I remember that game because you know, it was the derby, and was that the first leg or second leg?
It was the second leg.
The second leg, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I remember that. I scored at the front post, I think, from a cross or the atmosphere that day was amazing. They had heaps of fans, and we had thousands of fans as well. So, you know, it was all on, and you know, and I remember them, you know, their players as well. They had a good squad as well. And did they have the their coach was at the time the German?
Their coach was Terry Butcher.
Oh, was it Terry Butcher? Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, because he was jumping on the touchline, jumping up and down, and it was that game. Yeah, I'll never forget that game because that got us through. And then you know, just the whole atmosphere of the place and the noise. You know, that's what I recall when, you know, when you're winning games and you're scoring goals, it's, you know, the atmosphere is unbelievable there. So it's one of the hardest places to go and get a result at Newcastle. But you know, when you're the home team, it's brilliant.
Well, 24,338 fans. Yeah,
there you go.
Were there today, and that still stands as the largest home crowd for any Jets match.
Yeah. So. Nah, that was one of the best days of, you know, I would say that was probably the best time or the best game that I've played in front of, you know, at Newcastle. The second leg definitely is right up there. It was a really good day. It was a really good day. And then we went to Adelaide, wasn't it? Or
yes, yep, the following week.
I missed the penalty.
Well, before we get to that, you actually scored in that match as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
You scored in that match to bring
1-0 down. Yeah.
You brought it back to 1-1. It was a 74th minute goal, and
yeah,
it actually took it to extra time.
Yeah, because we were on top in that game, and then even Nick Carl, I think, hit the post or crossbar or something in the dying stages of the game. We could have gone, you know, and then extra time as well. Yeah, and then I remember missing my pen as well, which is bloody, yeah, it's not a great memory, to be honest.
So I want to ask you a question on that, but did you put, I guess it gets to extra time, you're knackered.
Mm.
Did you put your hand up to take one of those penalties?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's important that the ones that want to take it, you know, you know, put their hand up, and I was confident enough to go up, and you know, as a striker, it's and normally I'm normally pretty good, but on this day, I'll be honest, I changed my mind, and you know, after I'd done that, it was an easy save for him. I remember I sort of, you know, I normally go the other way, and then I went that way, and then I think Stewie then missed after me as well.
Yeah, he did.
Or they scored and then he missed, and then, you know, that was really – so from 1 week, you know, having that whole elation and, you know, joy, then to go there, one game away from the grand final, that was it was very tough to take that one, I'll be honest.
We have a couple of young listeners, I guess, to the podcast. Can you, as a striker who's played at a high level and internationally as well, how do you, as a player, prepare mentally to take a penalty in such a clutch situation? What advice can you pass on to the people who are listening who look, for them, the highest level that they might reach could be all age, but it's still the highest level for them.
Yep.
What sort of advice can you pass on to people in preparation for penalties?
Yeah, I would. My first thing would be to try and stay as calm as you can, because if anyone tells you that when there's a penalty shootout, that it's an easy walk up there, and you know, even if there's not much of a crowd, or you're playing school soccer, or you know, it doesn't matter. Every time, it's just a mind game as well. You know, I even when I was involved in shootouts all my career, like I remember going up there, the walk takes forever because, you know, it's only a 10-second walk, but it feels like it's forever. You go there and then you even, you know, I can even remember sometimes like even my legs starting to shake a little bit. Like I'm, you know, it's just part of it, and the crowd and, you know, putting the ball on the spot and just – it's very intimidating. It's just, you know, it's probably different than a penalty shootout's different than taking normal penalty, because you're in the middle of the game and you just, you know, you get the ball, you go up, bang, you put it down and he blows the whistle and then you go. But in a penalty shootout, there's so much at stake. There's, you know, a million things are running through your mind. So but the first thing I would say is try and stay calm as possible. You know, have a thought process in your mind, you know, what you want to do, or where you want to place it. You know, obviously making sure that you hit the target is the main priority. But, you know, the keepers these days are so good. And they play mind games with you as well. So it's really – it's not an easy situation, but, like, you know – if you've got, you know, the strong will and the character, you know, I would say get up there and take one, because you only sort of learn from, if you're a youngster, it's okay, you know, when you're missing them at under 9s, under 10s, under 11s, under 12s, it's just when you get a little bit more competitive, then it starts to mean a lot. So I would say, yeah, go for it and try and stay as calm as possible.
Fabulous advice, Vaughn. That's really good. It's yeah, to talk about the importance of keeping calm and I guess backing yourself and sticking to your routine.
Yeah,
that you have. I mean, we saw some pretty ordinary penalties recently between Italy and Germany.
Yeah,
and yeah, it's.
I always say to my son, I always say, look, you know, even the best players in the world miss penalties. You know, so it is. It's just a. You know, 9 times out of 10, you know, you can do it at training, you do it easily, you muck around and you knock at them in the back of the net all the time. But in those, you know, in the Euros, it's totally different again. You know, you've got 40, 50,000 people there. Yeah, it's more of a mind game. It's, you know, trying to keep everything in check and just keep your head. And you just, you know, if you do the right thing, I'm sure you'll be right.
There was a book that was released late last year, 10 years of the tumultuous, 10 years of the tumultuous A League, and in there are a number of anecdotes from former coaches and players about some of the lighter side of the A League and playing professional football. Are there any anecdotes or stories about your time with the Jets? Funny stories that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Look, I was, you know, I was actually quite a good boy, you know. I mean, I was at the time, I was a, you know, I was a father, I was a young father, so I didn't really, if you, you know, you're talking about stories and people doing silly things. I think, I mean, I know Nick Carl at the time was a little bit of a joker. Paul Ocon was as well. Yeah. You know, in the dressing room and all those sorts of things. But, you know, because I was new in town, you know, I wasn't a Newcastle boy. So I sort of, you know, I was always well-behaved at the time. But, yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, Nick Carl seems to me to be that he would be the sort of joker at training and those sorts of things.
Yeah, he was. He was, you know, he was good on the pitch. He was a funny guy as well. But then when he had to work, he worked really hard and worked, you know, he had a fantastic career as well. you know, Joel was good banter as well, you know. He was probably one of the ones that was never happy, or, you know, things, you know, this wasn't right or this wasn't right. He was always complaining about something. But then when it came to do his work, you know, he was an ultimate pro as well.
Yeah.
So, no real funny, I can't remember really any funny stories from my time there.
That's all right. That's okay. I've put you on the spot. So
yeah, sorry about that.
No, don't be sorry. That's fine. You part a company with the Jets in the off season to join the newly formed Wellington Phoenix.
Yep.
Was there an offer to stay in Newcastle, or was returning to Newcastle to help establish the franchise an offer too good to turn down?
Yeah, no, I wasn't offered. I actually wanted to stay in Newcastle, but I wasn't offered a new deal. So, look, by that time, like I was in my mid-30s, and this is when Wellington Phoenix came into the league. And to be honest, I thought my time was, you know, I'd done my time and I had a good career. So I was, but then, you know, Wellington Phoenix came in. And Ricky Herbert was the coach at the time, and he basically just said, look, you know, would you like to come? We're establishing a new team, and we want you as, you know, part of the leadership group, and just to mentor and help, in terms of playing time, you know, it would have been, you know, it was limited. I jumped at it, really, to be honest. You know, it was my hometown where I was born, and, you know, a new club coming into the league wanted to make an impression and help start build a good club. So that's how that eventuated. And, obviously, you know, finishing up there, my second year there. So yeah, it worked out pretty well in the end, you know. Just retiring in front of my family and all that sort of thing was a good way to go out, really.
So, following your retirement from competitive football, you've said that you're currently coaching. Who are you coaching for, and at what level are you coaching?
Yeah, so once I finished playing, I pretty much did my badges straight away, and I was involved with Melbourne Victory with the youth team as an assistant alongside Darren Davies. And then I've been there ever since for 6 years now, and just taken on a full-time role as a development coach with the under-20s in the NPL. So, it's a big club. It's had some wonderful success and produced, you know, some good young players. So I'm really happy what I'm doing. I love what I do. And, it's just a great opportunity, and I really enjoy my work.
You, as a striker, and we touched on it earlier that you were dropped from the team, and you're now coaching young players. What advice would you give to young players to them about being dropped from a team and how they can best respond?
Yeah, it's a good question, because you know, like I said to you before, as a player, the players always think about themselves, and, you know, can be selfish. Don't think about the team things as well. Whereas a coach, we're looking at a lot of different areas, the bigger picture. All I would say is, you know, if you're going to be dropped, then that's okay. It could be certain things. You might want to speak to the coach, or you know, you might want to ask the reason or any reason behind it. If it was something, it could be tactical, it could be physical. That could be the reason, or it could be just to do with form. And then if it's just to do with form, then I would say, well, you've got to continue to work hard and train hard on the pitch, because that's where you make your impression, and that's, you know, people can put their head down, and you know, poor body language is probably one of the worst things you could probably do in front of a coach, because that's not sending a very good message. Mm. You know, like I said, you know, if you are dropped, then, you know, there's got to be a reason. And I think most coaches are open. Their doors are normally open, so you can, you know, have a chat with them. And if there's an area that you need to improve or be better, then, you know, maybe that's, you know, that starts on the training pitch as well. And it, you know, I'm sure if you react well and the coach sees that reaction and it's positive, then you'll be back in again. So, you know, and the reasons why you're in a football club, or if you're at a, you know, if you're at an elite club or you're in a professional environment, you know, you're there for a reason, obviously, because you're a good player. You wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't sign you, or they wouldn't have you in that club. That goes for any professional club if you weren't good enough. So never stop, you know, believing and be confident. So
okay. No, yeah. Good advice. As a coach, as a player, you would have played under many different coaches, and you are now a coach yourself. Who are some of the coaches that you've learnt the most from, and in the approach that you now take as a full-time coach for a career?
Yeah, look, I've had some coaches in my day as well, with the national team as well. There was early on in my career, I had a coach called Bobby Clark, played for Scotland. He was very, very good. Learned a lot from him as well as a player. And then obviously with playing in the NSL as well, I had Frank Arock, who was I had a number of coaches in my time in the NSL as well, which you learn, like what I learn now is that as a player you take a little bit from every coach. You learn a little bit about everybody and how they react and how they talk and how they deliver stuff. So, you know, as a coach who I am now, I sort of bring little bits from everybody, and then try to have my own spin on it and my own philosophy on how I want to do things. And hopefully, you know, the players respect that, and you get your most out of your players that way. So, not one in particular I really learnt the most from, but I believe, you know, every coach is different, every manager is different, the way he, you know, the way he talks, the way he delivers stuff to you. So, but I think these days, you know, the game is getting so much faster, so much quicker. Mm. Which, you know, all coaches are looking for, you know, a little edge or gain somewhere, whether it's on the pitch, on the training pitch, sports science. So it's, I would just say, and even in those days with the NSL, I had Ange Postecoglou as well. So
yeah, right.
You know, at South Melbourne. So he was a good mentor. Someone, you know, didn't say much, but bloody hell. You know,
he was angry.
Well, yeah, pretty much. I mean, he didn't really need to talk. He just, you know, the way he looked at you, or the way he even, you know, stared at you, more or less said, well, you know, that it's not good enough. So
wow.
Yeah, you respected him that way, whereas other coaches or other managers would, you know, they would just, you know, they'd be going off, you know, and, you know, so that was a, you know, that was a different way of dealing with it. You might get a reaction, you know, for a while, but then, you know, Ange did it a different way, and I think he's pretty similar in the way he does things now. He does it. I've seen him coach. I've been with him at Melbourne Victory as well. He's, you know, very calm, and but the players have the ultimate respect for him. So,
yeah. Okay. We'll finish up with some really quick questions about your time with the Jets. feel free to throw anyone under the bus that you want. We talked to a couple of other ex-players as part of our off-season series. No one's throwing you under the bus, so it's just a bit of fun.
Yeah.
Who was your roomie with the Jets, and who was the most annoying roommate that you were with?
I think my roommate was, I remember, I know I was with Paul O'Connor a fair bit because we were two of the older, I think we were one of two of the older players at the time. But he was another one. He was a bit of a joker as well, and he's a good roommate to have as well. I can't even remember. Like, mate, it was so, how many years ago was that?
06, 07.
Yeah.
Yeah, so nearly 10 years ago.
10 years ago, yeah. My memory's not good.
Nah, that's all right. We can move on then to the next one if you like.
Yeah.
The best player that you played with during your career?
Best player I've played with?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good one as well. There's a couple of good players. In my South Melbourne days, it was Paul Trimboli, who was one of the best players I've played with. At international level, I played with a player called Winton Rufer. Who was played in Germany for many, many years. He was like top class. Mm. I think he won a Champions League or Europa League, Europa Cup. Winton probably at international level was one of the best players in the national team, and Paul Trimboli. At NSL days and even in the A-League. Yeah, I mean Ned and Paolo they'd had a fantastic career as well, and brought a lot of experience and that to Newcastle at the time as well. So those two, made a good impression to me anyway. You know, when I came there.
Yep. Did you have any pre-game superstitions?
No, not really. No, I didn't. I never liked being late. Never liked being late. Like if I was always early. I was probably one of the first ones always there. Mm-hmm. And then I just took my time getting ready. That was probably the only thing for me. So I didn't really have any superstitions. That was the main thing. Just didn't like being late.
Yeah. Okay. What team do you support?
Liverpool.
Oh. Good man. I should have asked that as the first question.
So, I have always, my father, when I was young, used to get me up. This would have been in the 70s probably, 70s, 80s, 80s probably, when they were winning a lot of things, and we used to get up in the morning, watch their FA Cup finals and stuff like that. So I really haven't stopped supporting them. And although my son now, he's a Man United fan, but I haven't jumped. I'm sticking with the Reds.
Yeah. No, you've got to stick. You can't change.
No.
If you didn't play football or involved in football, what do you think you would have been doing?
When I was at school, I wanted to be a farmer. Because obviously being from New Zealand and had family that was involved in farming and, from the rural side as well. I had a inkling for getting into it and then did a bit of, agriculture and stuff like that at school. But that obviously didn't eventuate. And then, because then I left, I finished school basically and came to Australia. It was a little bit after school when I was probably around 20, so... From then on, I was sort of from those early days, semi-pro, worked, and then, slowly got into full-time football.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. All right. Well, yeah. that's everything I've got today, Vaughn. Thank you so much for spending the time with us today. It was a really insightful chat. Thanks for spending the time with the Jetstream.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, guys. And, you know, like I said, Newcastle always holds, you know, good memories for me. It gave me the opportunity to play A-League. Really enjoyed my time in Newcastle. Wonderful people, you know, and still have some, you know, great friends that live up there and made some good friends. And we still visit all the time. So just want to say thank you and wish Newcastle and the fans all the best for the coming season. And you never know, might be back there one day.
Never know. Football's a funny business.
Yeah.
All right, Vaughn, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.